We have with us the author of a book called High Notes, a Rock Memoir. Richard Loren joins us. And Richard, I got to tell you, I actually read the book on a trip to the Dominican Republic I had. I read it on the plane and also on the beach a couple days, and it's a fantastic book. I loved it.
Well, good. I'm happy to hear that.
It's a lot of fun to read, and a lot of great memories of some great music. This is a good one, and I should let people know that it's from highnotes.org, East Pond Publishing, and you can get it at Amazon and all over the place. High Notes, a Rock Memoir by Richard Loren, L-O-R-E-N. And it's a funny book because, you know, when you read about Jefferson Airplane and the Doors and the Grateful Dead, you don't expect to see the name Liberace in the same conversation. But that was how you started. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was kind of interesting, really, because I really wanted to be a chiropractor when I was in college, but I fell head over heels for an actress in college, joined the drama club committee, dated her for 6 months, and I became enamored with theater and changed to an English drama major. So when I graduated college, I caught a break and became a theater manager for a summer term theater in Baltimore. In the final week of the summer season, Liberace played at the theater. He was impressed with the job I had done, fulfilling the requirements of the contract, etc., you know. And his agent and manager came to see him at the closing night, and he recommended to his agent that they hire me. So I was interviewed the following week in New York, and I began work pretty much immediately as an agent in training. I was appointed the job of booking colleges, and however, the agency that I worked with, they didn't represent any artists of interest to college, hip college students in those days. You know, they had like Liberace and Harry Belafonte and Anita Bryan. So if I wanted to keep my job, I found I had to find some rock artists to book. So I was kicked off at the Jefferson Airplane, where they'd be playing for a club in the village called the Cafe Agogo. So I went down there and parked myself there for a couple of weeks and was able to ingratiate myself with the airplane manager, Bill Graham, and the airplane's founder, Marty Ballin. I was introduced to Bill. I introduced Bill to my boss, and he and Marty agreed to the representation by the company. And I became an East Coast agent, and then Bill came on board shortly after that.
You know, I'm a big Jefferson Airplane fan and Jefferson Starship and the whole deal. And I had the thrill of interviewing Marty Ballin and Gracie Slick on a couple of occasions, and also some of their other members. But one of the things I was really intrigued by in terms of the book was the part about Liberace, because there was a movie recently in the last couple of years with Michael Douglas. I think it was on HBO. Did you catch the movie? And
I thought it was excellent. Matt Damon did a great job, and I don't really address him other than my experience with him for that week, you know. And I found him to be warm, affectionate, just a regular, just good guy. I mean, he would sit there and an hour or so after the show and just write, sign autographs after he'd done a 3-hour show. And I mean, he was very, very, very warm, nice guy.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a huge problem here in New England with all the snow, and one of the things that happened was a building collapsed called the Piano Store, and in it was a $500,000 glittery piano of Liberace's, but it actually survived the collapse, one of the only pianos that survived, so it's kind of good.
Amazing, yeah. He was quite an entertainer. I mean, I was like 21 years old when I saw him for the first time, and I never expected, you know. I'd seen him on black and white TV, he had his own show and so on. He was a little bit fairy, and if it had gotten Liberace. But when he came in, you know, and I got to meet him, and then I watched him perform, I mean, he was one of the most amazing entertainers I've ever seen. You know, completely different than the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bill Graham used to say, the Grateful Dead are not the best at what they do. They're the only ones that do what they do. And then I thought about Liberace, you know, and I said, he's also in that same category. And, you know, that was one of the ideas that kind of sparked me to write this book, you know. I looked at the Liberace on one end of the Grateful Dead and the other as bookends. And,
yeah,
you know, with Jim Morrison and the Jefferson Airplane right in between, you know, and I'd met a kid that was a Dead fan, and he said, man, you got to write this book. And I was in the middle of producing Rock in the Cradle, the Grateful Dead's 30th anniversary of their performance in Egypt, and I couldn't do it. But 4 years later, I just sat down and I started to write. You know, it took me 4 years, but I did it on my own terms.
Well, I think it's great. I love this book. And again, you know, you take us through your time bailing Jim Morrison out of jail, bringing marijuana across the border for Spencer Dryden, managing Jerry Garcia, sitting in his place, partying with him up in the hills, in the mountains there. I was with you on the trip, and I think that's one of the great things about this book, because, again, you know, I happen to be a guy that has interviewed some of these folks, but for folks out there who are just reading about it and trying, it actually puts you in that experience of being with these folks.
Yeah, well, as Jerry Garcia would say about any experience that was pleasurable, he'd say it was a fat trip. And for me, you know, those 2 decades that I spent with these people were really a fat trip. It was, you know, I gave my rites of passage in the music world, you know, with these rock icons who were my own age. They were contemporaries. But, you know, I would have, like, when I started off, I had 1 foot in the business world and the other foot in the rock world. And, you know, I just found that being in the presence of artists whom I felt an affinity for rather than businessmen whom I felt no connection. You know, I just felt, you know, at a certain point I quit the agency business and I really didn't know what I was going to do. And then just, you know, by some good fortune, I happened to meet Jerry for the first time.
That's interesting. You also have people in here that I wasn't familiar with, but now I am, like the Rowan brothers. I had no idea who they were.
Yeah. Well, Peter Rowan was their older brother, and he was a good friend of David Grisman, who, and I worked with both of those guys in the early days of the agency business. They were in a group called Earth Opera, but they were both originally bluegrass kids. And David had met Jerry in 64. But anyway, Peter was an incredible singer-songwriter, and he was in a lot of different bands, but he was an older in the way with Jerry and David Grisman and Vassar Clemens, and it was a bluegrass band that they formed in 73. It was very short-lived, but Peter was really good. But when I first met I reconvened with David Grisman after I hadn't seen him for a few years, he was working with the Rowan brothers, who were Peter's younger brothers, and they were really good-looking kids, and we thought, wow, we could really make this happen. And, you know, they were very singles-oriented, but, you know, like a lot of things that don't come to fruition, it takes a lot of elements to make things really be successful. And even though we got a great big contract at Columbia Records for them, and we had all the right, you know, all the right things in place, it just didn't happen, you know. And that gave me the opportunity to meet Jerry, actually. I mean, to work for Jerry, because Jerry was involved with the Rowan Brothers. He played on their record, and when my involvement with the Rowan Brothers terminated, I just went up to Jerry's and we started to talk, and he noticed that I was, you know, a little bit down in the mouth. He said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, you know, this job with the Rowan Brothers is over. I don't really have anything happening." He said, "Well, come and work for me. I need help, you know." He said, "Outside the Grateful Dead." So that's how it all began. You know, the failure of one thing and the beginning of something else.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really intrigued me about the book, you're kind of an adventurer in addition to doing what you do here in music. And I love the whole story of you traveling to Italy and going out to Europe and going to Holland and trying to find the special cannabis indica, a different strain than cannabis sativa, and going to Lebanon and I was just intrigued by the whole thing. You know, you're meeting the Egyptian guy and telling you about this stuff. It's a fantastic story. And
It was really funny. You know, it was like one of those situations that just come upon. You know, it's like you can't write fiction. Reality is greater than fiction in so many ways. You know, it's like I couldn't write that, you know, if I was trying to think of some adventure that I wanted to discuss, you know.
Yeah, and you were talking with this guy about Pakistani hash that you smoked. All of a sudden, he's talking about Zed Habab, the smoker's holy grail, and you ask him, "What is that shit?" And he tells you, and there you have your goal for life to go find that. And I thought the whole adventure was hilarious. And again, you know, you ended up on your feet when you get back, and I guess you had some breaks along the way, but you made your own breaks, too.
Yeah, well, you know, things happen. And that's one of the things I addressed in the book, you know, because the book is really not about any particular artist or paying to Jerry or whatever, even though, you know, he was just such an important figure in my life. But it turned out that it was a way for me to truly know myself in a profoundly affecting way, you know. It was like a voyage of self-discovery. And, you know, it was like a, I don't know, it was almost a spiritual pilgrimage looking back on your life and, you know, the different roads you can take and starting to figure out, well, why do things happen? You know, is it genes? Is it fate? Is it destiny? Is it the alignment of the stars at your birth? You know, I start thinking, well, wow, you know, God, I'm so, it's what a good fortune this thing is. It just happened to me, you know?
Yeah.
And, so it's a lot of that. And, you know, it's a lot of, you know, when I first started off, I was really ambitious. You know, I was, you know, very capitalistic and I'm going to make a lot of money and I'm going to do this. And all of a sudden, you know, those values dropped away. And I decided that I, you know, and I think I got to say, you know, the sacred herb really helped change my mind. I mean, I find, and I believe to this day that marijuana is really a gateway to consciousness. And I think that it was a great experience that I had when I first, I mean, that was later in life when I was exposed to it. I mean, 22 today, kids are 12 years old, but, you know, and we use that not as an escape or anything, but it was a way to wake up and see things in a different light, from a different perspective. You know, and you enjoy music so much more. You enjoy conversation so much more. And I felt, to me, that's an important thing in my life, and it's done me good, you know.
Well,
it
comes across. I really enjoyed the book. It's called High Notes, a rock memoir by Richard Lauren, and it's published by highnotes.org, East Pond Publishing. And again, you can go to highnotes.org for information on it. It's a fantastic book. I really loved it, Richard, and I'm glad you wrote it.
Oh, great. I really appreciate Mark coming from you. I mean, you've been around a long time. 40 years in radio, huh? Wow.
Yeah, long time.
You started at 9 years old?
I started at 9 years old in radio, at a local station. Yep.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, I was reading up on you yesterday. I mean, I couldn't believe the experiences you've had in your life. I mean, you're still a young guy, right? You're not even 50 yet, right?
No, I wish I could say that. I'm 60, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've been around.
So you kind of just missed out on this, on the movement of the 60s, you know, the counterculture, the stuff.
No, I was part of that, actually. I held a anti-Vietnam rally in my college, and I was actually kind of involved in all that stuff when I was younger.
Oh, great,
of course, the drug thing, you know, we all did that if we grew up in the 60s. Everybody was into that, so, you know, that's why I really, I think this is fantastic, and I think anybody our age, and even if you're over 50, you're going to really enjoy this thing, and because you'll appreciate Jefferson Airplane and the Dead and all the folks that are in here, the Jim Morrisons. Morrison, boy, he was an out-of-control guy, huh?
Wow. But he was like a shaman for his generation, you know. He broke us through to the other side. You know, in Jim, I could see the power of the news, you know, as it flowed through, you know, to make itself known, kind of. And he never knew what he was going to do next on stage. He was like amazing. I mean, the Doors behind them. I mean, they were so, you know, their music was so impeccably arranged and to underscore, you know, Jim's poetry, his choreography on stage and stuff. I mean, those guys seemed to be telepathically connected. It was amazing to watch those shows with them because I never knew what was going to happen with Jim, you know. Like, you watch a show with Mick Jagger, for instance, you know, and I love the Stones, don't get me wrong. But, you know, you look at Jagger and then you go back and you look at, you know, James Brown, and you know where Mick got it from.
Mm-hmm.
But with Jim, there was no looking back at who he got it from. You know, he was possessed in a way.
He was. You say he broke on through to the other side. He also led them to the end. So
You know, but he once told me, you know, he said, I don't want to live an old, become an old man, you know.
He got his wish, unfortunately.
And you know, like a lot of people, Mark, you know, you got Jim Belushi, you got Jimi Hendrix, you got, you know, and they're like shooting stars. It's like a lot of these people you really can't imagine as older people after a while. I mean, how do you top a Jim Belushi in his 20s? How do you top a Jim Morrison before he got that bust in Miami. I mean, I was with him in those important years, you know, where he had kind of set it all from the beginning of Light My Fire till 1969, 70. After that, it was nothing but a hassle for Jim, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you stop putting on weight, you start to get, you know, you get exposed to all these excesses, and it's over, kind of. I mean, you have to be, I mean, Jim was never a moderate guy. How could you see him in old age as a moderate person, you know?
Mm.
Or Jim Belushi, or any of those people. I think it's their destiny. They come in, they say their thing, and they're out the door.
Well, you got Jimmy Dean, James Dean, and
yeah.
And also Janis Joplin, another one. Just,
right. You know,
it's very sad, but you do wonder what would they be like if they had lived, and who knows?
Yeah. You know, and a lot of it, you know, it's accidental. I mean, Janis didn't want to die. You know, I don't think Jimmy really wanted to die, and you know, it's just it's destiny there, kind of in a way. You know, it's just not paying attention is how you die that way, too. You know, Jim, what's his name, James Dean, you know, he died because he drove too fast in a fast Porsche, you know.
Yeah.
Janis died because she wasn't aware of what she was injecting, you know.
Yeah.
Jim died because he just gave up. He just wanted to become a poet. I don't want to be in this rock and roll. I mean, in the beginning years, when I was in the first 2 or 3 years, he was really into it, you know. And then I could just see, after those 2 years, you know, I mean, he, like I said in my book, you know, he was calling him to quit on a major tour.
Mm,
and,
yeah.
You know, they had to talk him into playing. He said, I don't want to, I'm sick of it. You know, it's kind of like he was a poet at heart. But, in a way, you know, the Doors are so amazing because they're a poet with a backup band. And that's so rare in music. I mean, outside of, Dylan, but he has many bands. But, you know, you got Leonard Cohen, and you've got a few others. But
yeah.
no one as big as Jim when it's really about poetry and music behind it to support the poetry. I mean, people write songs and great lyrics, don't get me wrong. But there's a difference between poetry and...
Yeah,
and,
you got Rod McEwen, and you got... Yeah, exactly what you said. Even Bob Dylan at one point might have been considered a poet, but he didn't really have a band behind him.
I think the Doors are unique in that way. And I just found, all these three main people that I worked for were so unique, and I feel, you know, really blessed to have been involved with them. And even Grace and Marty, they're notable figures, you know, and, you know, all the Jefferson Airplane. And, Marty was one of the most amazing people, you know, I've met. He's a friend to this day. I spent time with him in Tampa. But, you know, I mean, he was the one who started the San Francisco scene. You know, in those days, Marty was the businessman initiator as well as the leader of the band. He, you know, he looked for managers and clubs for bands to play. In fact, he started the Matrix, which is the club in San Francisco that, you know, other groups began to play there. And, you know, he put up some money. He got a couple of investors because they needed a place to play.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's, you know, the Doors played there in 1967. And I think it might even be a bootleg CD out on it. But, the Airplane were really special. You know?
Yeah.
And it was really interesting, you know, starting off as a kid, you know, I mean, I came out of the straight world kind of. You know, when you're a little older, you know, you don't get turned on to marijuana. You don't get, like, you know, you don't get that illumination until late in your life, you know, like 22 or 23. So when I met these guys who were my age, but they were experienced a little earlier than I was, you know,
mm-hmm.
long hair and crazy clothes, you know. And I'm just this kid with, fashionably long hair, trying to look cool, you know, sport jacket and jeans. And, you know, start hanging out with these guys, and it's like, oh, who's this kid, you know,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm their contemporary, you know, so just, you know, it really shaped my life, these guys, you know, they were really, you know, and the music they provided, I mean, really, it really shaped my life and spoke to my soul, you know, music. I've always been a big fan of music.
Yeah, as am I, and in fact, it defines our life, you know. You think about different parts of your life, and you think of the songs that went with it.
Right, but, right. I mean, music is a special thing, for sure. You know, I mean, it's a great thing, and it's just great, just a wonderful experience.
Well, Richard Loren, I enjoyed speaking with you, and if you're ever in Boston, get in touch, and we'll get together and have lunch or something like that.
I'd love to. Do you live in Boston itself?
I used to live in a suburb there, but now I'm on the Cape. I'm on Cape Cod.
Oh, cool. So that's where you do the show from?
I do the show from Cape Cod, yeah.
So you're just basically based there, huh?
I am. I'm based here. I used to go all around the country and do interviews live, but not anymore. I've it's a little easier to just go downstairs to the basement now and do my interviews.
Yeah, that's terrific. There's nothing like that, you know. At a certain time in your life, you got to passionately embrace leisure, you know.
Exactly. That's my thing. Unfortunately, we're buried in snow here, but we're still getting out with this interview, and we're still bringing out the High Notes from Richard Loren, a rock memoir. It's available. Go down to highnotes.org and check it out. It's a really fascinating book, and I think you'll like it.
You can get a signed copy for me if you buy it online on my website at www.highnotes.org, and I'll send it right out to anybody, both paperback and hardcover.
Well, when we put this thing up on the web on pmpnetwork.com, we'll include a link to that site for you.
Yeah. So what is the network, Mark?
It's pmpnetwork.com, like Peter Mary Paul Network.com.
Okay, great.
We have over 1,000 interviews on there from people from music, TV, and movies, and you will be on there sometime probably during the weekend or next week early.
Wonderful. So you put these shows together, and then you have an editor that edits it? And
we have no editor. All the interviews are put up unedited.
Wonderful.
Yep, there's no editing here. We just go with the flow, and that's it.
Don't make it. All right.
That's exactly
like
right.
That,
yeah, I guess,
I,
you're, like I guess you're looking at the webcast.
Well, I wasn't really familiar with that site. I'm going to go check it out.
All right. It's good to talk to you, Richard.
All right. Thanks again, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye.